So this is going to be the first Mike watches a movie vertical.
Yes.
And at the end of the episode, I will announce there is going to be another one next
there
week.
There is.
Which I'm excited about. So, The Princess Bride.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you please give a little bit of context to this movie? Like, because it's one of those films that is a cult classic, right?
It is a cult classic.
Why is that the case? Like, do you have any kind of feeling as to why The Princess Bride is a cult classic?
So we talked about it in Incomparable episode 25. I think one of the... So I was late to the Princess Bride. I went off to college and people were quoting lines from The Princess Bride and I had no idea what was going on. And then I didn't see the movie until I was maybe out of college even at that point. So I think for some reason this movie is particularly quotable. I think the heightened, it's the storybook element that these are tropes that we're used to seeing in fairy tales with a knowing and kind of postmodern, knowing spin. There's a commentary on this kind of story that's happening inside the story. Plus, it's got the framing device with Peter Falk and Fred Savage. So, you're commenting on it as a story while it's happening. I think all of that is kind of mixed in there, that this is very quotable. And I would say for the period in my life, when this came out, the reason that all the college students in my college were quoting it also is, when you're younger, this is the kind of movie that is both familiar in the sense that it is an old fashioned fairy tale and also, beautifully, different in that it is winking at the whole thing, and that's clever. And I think, especially when you're, high school, college age, you love that idea that somebody is taking this form that you've been seeing your entire life and is now playing with it and winking at it. So, but if I had to pick one thing, it's that it's just insanely quotable.
So when I first started hearing people mention The Princess Bride kind of on the internet and on shows like yours, there was something in my brain that got it mixed up with the Anne Hathaway movie, The Princess Diaries. And I was very confused as to why all of these nerds enjoyed The Princess Diaries so much. The Princess Diaries has a 6.2 on IMDb. And it's about... Mia Thermopolis has just found out that she is the heir to the apparent throne of Genovia. So it's like a regular American girl who finds out she's a princess, basically. So I was very confused. But then once I was able to break the confusion, the interesting
Anne
thing
Hathaway
is
not in The Princess Bride.
She is not in The Princess Bride.
Julie Andrews, not in The Princess Bride.
Not at all. Not even a little bit. It is interesting, though, that even though I have never seen this movie, it has snuck into my conscience. Like, I am aware of the references. I am aware of Inconceivable. I am aware of Would You Like a Peanut? I am aware of these things. They have snuck in. And I always find that interesting when you can relate to the reference and can even make the reference without actually knowing the source material. So that's one of those interesting things that happens in...
That's what happened to me in college at first, too. It's like, oh, I don't know. Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. Oh, yeah, I know that reference. I know it from other references, but not from the actual movie. But from the references, yeah.
So I have to make one brief aside to read verbatim from my notes. And my notes say, oh, my Robin Wright.
Yes.
She is beautiful.
Oh, yes.
In this movie, she is just incredibly beautiful. I am only very familiar with her from House of Cards.
House of Cards, right, sure.
Where, of course, she is also a beautiful lady, but she's younger, probably closer to my age in The Princess Bride. I was going to call it Diaries.
No.
She's very stunning, and she's kind of, in her look, the perfect look for a fairy tale princess. It makes perfect sense, right? And as well, the way that the movie starts, I find to be very interesting because it starts off as like this idyllic romance story, right? And it's very well done. I like that a lot because it's kind of like with is it Carrie? How do you say Carrie?
Carrie Elwes.
That's it. Carrie Elwes and Robin Wright are these two blonde, beautiful, blue-eyed, you know, like,
oh, sure,
perfect fairy tale stars. And it's like, you know, like soft focus lens, you know, they're like in love. It starts off really well. And I love how the young boy, is it Fred Savage, right?
Yeah.
He's just like, is this a kissing book? And I just think so funny, like the way I just really enjoyed the way that it started. I have a real love for Andre the Giant, just in general. I was a pro wrestling fan as a kid.
Oh.
And remember fondly watching Andre, you know, the biggest man in the world, you know, fighting, yeah, Hulk Hogan.
He apparently was given his lines phonetically for this because he didn't speak English very well at all.
No, he's French.
French, yeah.
Yeah, and never did speak English very, yeah, well.
But I would argue that it enhances that character, that he's sort of this somewhat impenetrable, confusing giant man. It's like, yeah.
And they paint him as quite simple as well, you know, because he's
and
like...
sweet.
Which is great. And I really like that because when... Inigo says right at the very end, he's like, is it Fezzik? Is that how you
Fezzik.
Say it? Fezzik,
yeah.
Like, you have finally done something right. Like when they're making their escape.
Right. You know? Well, there's a nice moment where they're on the chase and he said he wants to fight them, and he says, no, hide behind a rock and throw and a boulder and throw rocks at them. And he says, my way is not very sporting. He's like upset. He's like, no, that's not, because he's a good guy. He's not a bad guy. Vizini is bad, but Fezzik is a very nice giant person.
Mm-hmm. Andre in this role is so fantastically terrible. Like,
yeah,
that's what's so good about him.
It's endearing.
Yeah.
It's endearing. He is an endearing character, and it is in part because he is not an actor, and his lines are kind of, you know, muddled. And yet I think it works because of that. I think it makes you love that big lug.
Yeah, I mean, because he's cast because he's the closest you can get to a giant.
To a giant, yeah.
You know, like, he's 7 foot tall or so, and he suffers with gigantism, you know, so he kind of has, mm-hmm, these larger-than-life features. So he's kind of perfect for the role that they're fitting. One of the things that I really liked about the book, like the storytelling device, is when it would break to like the present day,
mm-hmm,
and then the grandfather would start to read the story back, and you'd see the flashes of it happening.
Mm-hmm.
So like he would start to tell the story, and it would
be
his
was
narration.
I?
Yeah, where was I? And he'd start reading the parts, and then start flashing around again. And I don't know if this is something that is intended, and I wonder how you feel about that. But you know, when the grandson complains about certain ways that the story's going, I had the feeling that his grandfather was changing the story.
Ah, interesting.
Because he's like, oh, but you know, such and they shouldn't get away or whatever, and he'd be like, oh no, wait, just let me continue. Because they seem to like at these points that the story takes sharp turns.
Well, but what goes against that is that there's a moment where he says, you know, what happens to Prince Humperdinck? So, you know, how does he die in the end? And he says, no, he lives. He lives. He gets away with it. And the grandson says, Jesus, Grandpa, why are you reading this book to me?
Yeah, I like that bit. I like that.
Yeah, the whole commentary, the, you know, stop with the kissing and all of that, and you know, that is I think it's a great framing sequence to have them all, you know, commenting on the story as they go. Like, this is a fairy tale. We are listening to and watching a fairy tale as it happens.
I think single-handedly the best scene in this movie is the whole scene when, you know, Wesley, who is the Dread Pirate Roberts, is scaling the wall and Inigo is waiting for him.
Oh.
And their whole back and forth, and then the very civil conversation that they have about their lives, and you know, talking about how they got there, and then have the fantastic fight, which is, mm-hmm, so well done. Because there are so many parts of it where it's clearly, you know, it is Mandy Patinkin and Cary Elwes, who yeah. Mandy Patinkin, like the guy from Homeland. I was like, oh my God, it's yeah. the guy from Homeland. That whole scene makes the movie. Like, the movie could have been so much worse than it was, because overall, I will spoil it, overall, I really enjoyed this movie. That is just so, it's such fantastic, just everything, comedy and just great storytelling. Like, the whole, it just worked so well for me. I really, because it frames those characters so well, you know, like they're full of honor and like, you know, they will die for the cause. Right. And
you seem a good man. I hate to kill you. You seem yeah. a good man. I hate to die. and the you get the double. I'm not left-handed. I'm not left-handed
yeah.
either.
Yeah. All of, and then like, you know, one would knock the sword out of his hand, so he'd pick up the sword and knock the, and like no one would kill yeah. each other at that point. And I really love the line, "There's not a lot of money in revenge."
Yeah.
I'm in the revenge business. Like, that is just so fantastic.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite lines in the movie is also where they're talking about the different sword techniques, and Mandy Patinkin says, "If he has studied his Agrippa, which I have." So it's a non sequitur, which I have. Okay. Mandy Patinkin, angry Spaniard with a sword. And I like that he, you know, in the end Cary Elwes knocks him out, right? He's not gonna kill him. This pirate that we don't know anything about, he's not gonna kill Inigo. He's a good guy.
Right. So this is where that leads to a big question for me, and sure. please correct me if I've got something wrong here. So Wesley knocks out Inigo.
Mm-hmm.
He does the same to Fezzik. He puts him in a sleeper hold. That yep. whole thing is hilarious because there's no way Wesley would have survived that. Like,
he's ribs crushed.
Yeah. yeah. which that's a great, like, that I love all of that as well. But then
sleep well and dream of large women, he says as he leaves Fezzik behind.
That's
a quotable.
Good line. And then when it comes to Vizzini, he kills
yes.
him.
Well, Vizzini really kills himself, but he is the worst. He is the worst of them, right? He's the instigator of this, and he's telling them to kill. That's why you see him say, "Throw rocks at their heads and all of that, and don't be sporting about it. Just kill them." It's because Vizzini is—he's arrogant. He doesn't care if they die. He's just in it for the money. And then it's his own arrogance that kills him in the end, because he dies with his own poison. Which is funny.
Yeah, it's just...
Look over there. What is that?
It's
I don't see anything.
It's just very interesting. Like, yeah, I get true. It, because the other guys, they're just like hired help.
Yeah, right. They're trying to make money. They're in it for the work, and you also get the sense that as it goes, they're increasingly uncomfortable with what Vizzini is trying to do. That this is not necessarily what they signed up for. And he's the instigator of it. So yeah, he ends up dying in the end. But even then, he doesn't end up dying at the hand of the man in black. He ends up dying at his own hand. He's just outwitted by the man in black.
But he put poison. But yeah, he was always going to kill him.
That's true. He did put poison in his cup. That's true. Yeah. He did actually poison him, and he died. This is true.
Like, it wasn't like he was in that the episode of Sherlock where the pills, right? Where it's like this right. game of wits as to who's going to take. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, I think it's the second episode, and they're playing that game of wits as to who's gonna take the pills, because he just, like, you know, Wesley says that he built up an intolerance to the poison.
Yeah, so they're both going to drink the poison, and yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. That's true. He does. He kills him. He sort of, I mean, he set up that he sort of deserves it. It's a great death. Never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line. And then he dies.
Couldn't it be as far from a Sicilian accent as possible, which I loved.
Yeah. It's just Wallace Shawn being yeah. Wallace Shawn.
He's an incredible no attempt, voice.
Yeah. yeah.
So then we kind of get to the point where then Wesley is, he's caught Buttercup, and they're on their way, and we're treated to one of the most ridiculous scenes I've ever seen in cinema, which at this point I am enjoying, when they're tumbling down the hill.
Oh.
And the noises they're making.
Oh, yeah.
It's so... And they show one part where, like, the stunt double who's filling in for Buttercup takes a terrible turn at one point.
Yeah.
Like, it looks really painful. So that's kind of beautifully ridiculous. And then So there are some weird points in this movie, right? Where it kind of it took me out a couple of times. Like, so then when they're in the
right after that, they get to the fire swamp and there's the big Muppet rodents.
That's what that's what I'm going to talk about. And the incredibly violent fight between Wesley and one of the giant rodents.
That's where we see them. He stabs the ROUS like multiple times with his sword. Yeah.
Yeah, and he is bitten. Quite savagely a few times as well, which is interesting. It's just the movie kind of didn't stick to anything. Like I felt like it kept changing around a lot, but the whole time, like I'm entertained throughout it all. And I really like that this is such a weird and varied cast, because then we're met by Mel Smith.
Who is
a British actor who plays the character known as the albino.
The albino. Mm-hmm.
But Mel Smith is like, he's familiar to me because he is a very famous British comedy actor and drama actor. Like, he's been lots and lots and lots of British TV. So it's just very peculiar to see some of the casting. Like, it's just, it's so out of left field, a lot of it. And it's like, I never really, there just didn't seem to be like a real kind of cohesion, but not in a bad way. It's just it's like I kept being surprised by the faces that I was recognizing, you know?
Right.
And then there's like the very peculiar pain machine, the suction machine.
Yes.
Which is really weird. And then Wesley is killed, and then they take him to the miracle worker.
Mm-hmm.
I loved all of that. Who is it that plays the miracle worker?
It's Billy Crystal.
Yes, because I knew
and Carol Kane is his wife. Yeah.
That whole scene is just so fantastic. It's very Woody Allen-like.
Yeah, it's a bizarre sort of like just a comedy sketch scene all on its own, but it's great. At the Miracle Max shop, he's like, he's only, mostly dead is partially alive. And Valerie, leave me alone. Because she's like, you're a liar. You can save him. And yeah, that's a funny bit. They did a retrospective on The Princess Bride in a magazine that I was reading last year, and Billy Crystal and Carol Kane were interviewed, and they said they'd be up for a Princess Bride sequel since they could play their parts without makeup now.
Yeah, because they're very old characters,
yes,
aren't they?
Like, yeah, they're like, aged up in that one.
They're like anciently old. Like,
yeah.
That actual nobody really lives to kind of old, because like, they're like witches and wizards, I guess, something along that line.
Right.
And then we're treated to the fact, so Wesley is brought back to life, and just in just pure comedy.
Saved by Inigo and Fezzik.
Yes.
And brought back to life.
Yes, yes. How he cannot function correctly.
Right, he's paralyzed, basically.
And the way he moves his body around is just so incredible. Like, you know, to move his arm, he like has to get momentum from his other shoulder to like throw it around. And then the whole instigation of this episode, the Holocaust cloak, is brought up.
The list among our list of assets is we also have a Holocaust. That's a funny scene, because they're like, well, there's, you know, what do we do, there's too many guys down there, and then he says, oh well, if we have a Holocaust cloak, then, and then they put Andre the Giant on the bonfire thing, and
yeah,
I'm the Dread Pirate Roberts, he says.
Like, there's a few things about this. So one, like, I love the introduction of the Holocaust cloak is great. It's like, I liked it, so I took it, and the guy said I could have it, which is how Vesic says that he has it. But then there is no explanation. So I looked this up as to why he could be set on fire.
He's high up and also a giant. I don't know.
I looked it up, and apparently a Holocaust cloak is impervious to flame.
Ah.
And I think that there is something Dungeons & Dragons related.
Interesting.
Because I found a Yahoo Answers article, and one of the points in here, where does it say? I'm sure... here we go. Any who attack the wearer of the cloak must save versus magic or suffer 2d8 points of damage from the flames, and any weapon they strike with must make a saving throw or be damaged as well.
There you go.
Now, I only know about that from your show. I would not have understood any of that, but Total Party Killers prepared me for the Holocaust cloak.
Good. I'm glad to provide the service. So yeah, that the... It works in that they scare off the fear of the Dread Pirate Roberts, combined with this horrible flaming giant thing moving toward them scares off most of the guards. And then the guy with the gate key says, I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, you mean this gate key here? And he runs off and they get into the castle for the last momentous bit where you have to save the princess and stop the six-fingered man, who is Christopher Guest.
Mm-hmm. More great actors in this movie.
Well, that's a nice showdown where he can't move too, right? And the prince is there, and it's unclear whether he has any strength or not to get up from the bed, but he talks the prince into giving up without a fight.
Yeah, what is the line that he uses? Something about pain.
To the pain.
To the pain, not to the death, yeah. And
right.
It's this great kind of like rousing speech as to how he will make, you know, his life misery.
He'll cut off all of his arms and legs and...
leave his ears, his perfect ears.
Yes, your ears you keep, and I'll tell you why. Yeah, quotable.
And I really enjoyed this whole scene. There's a lot of action in it, and I like Indigo's scene with his retribution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a good scene. And it kind of, you know, it ends nicely. Everybody's happy. And the grandson ends up having enjoyed the book. And then you get, you know, the payoff, as you wish at the end, you know, saying that somehow in some sort of time traveling timeline, because of
how could it be?
Yeah, because it's hundreds of years later.
Well. Oh, that grandpa, he says crazy stuff.
I really enjoyed this movie.
Good. I'm glad. Were the accents acceptable to you? Because there are some Americans doing British accents in this movie.
I was confused by it a lot because I kind of couldn't understand where they were attempting to have this movie set.
That's because Americans don't understand about regional British accents. It's just fairy tale Britain is where it's set.
Well, there's just
except it's actually Florin and Gilder, so it's which are currencies, but you know, so theoretically that could be like in Italy, but it's nowhere. But most people with some exceptions are trying on English accents to some degree, fake and not fake.
So my problem with it is there's no commitment. Like there's nobody will commit to a certain. So they will not get everybody to commit to a certain accent, right? Because you have a Spanish guy, you have a French guy, you have Americans pretending to be English, you have Americans that are just don't even care and are just being American and saying they're Sicilian.
Yeah, like, well, it's more like there are New Yorkers in this movie.
Yeah.
It's the Miracle Max and Vizzini are both sort of just doing New York accents Miracle Max's wife, Valerie, too. You know.
So even though everybody's talking British, a lot of the main characters are talking in British accents, and that's because it's medieval times. Many, 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 many medieval time movies, everybody has British accents. I don't know where this started, but it seems like something that I've seen a bunch. I assumed that it was Italy, because Florin sounds Italian, and obviously you've got Vizzini, who's Sicilian. Like, it just kind of made sense to me that it would be Italy.
Yeah, it is made up though. I mean, Gilder is it was a like Holy Roman Empire currency, and a florin was an Italian currency, and they're named. So florin and Gilder are just named for currencies. It's the Florence currency was the florin, so it's all made up.
The setting doesn't really give anything.
No,
it kind of could be anywhere in the
world. Lots of hills and a little medieval city, and yeah.
But I enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it.
I'm glad you did.
My girlfriend didn't.
Oh.
I don't know why she...
Huh. No reasons given?
She just didn't think it was very entertaining. That was kind of her... She
hates me now.
Probably. I don't know how she's going to feel after my next assignment.
What's your next assignment, Mike?
So I enjoyed this enough that I would like to do it again. And we're going to do it again next week. And this is because, basically, I know that The Princess Bride is kind of important to you. It's a movie that you enjoy.
Yeah, I love it, yeah.
But there's a movie that is extremely important to you that references are made, and I don't get them. And it's about time that I do, and that's Real Genius.
Yes.
So I am going to watch Real Genius in between now and next week's episode, and we will do a second Mike Watches a Movie Vertical. This is not going to be every week, by the way.
No,
maybe.
Although
it may
recur.
Yeah, and I think there's a funness in it because you are obviously a man who very much enjoys movies. You know, The Incomparable shows that, of course. And I also very much enjoy movies, but I have big gaping holes in my movie history. And I don't even want to tell you about some of them, or we'll be doing this forever. And so I think it might be fun. I think it might be fun. We do it at the end of the show, and people can can choose if they want to listen,
exactly,
or not.
So I had one more note about The Princess Bride, just to say one of the reasons that I think it's interesting and relevant is that the director of this movie is Rob Reiner, and I think one of the reasons people it's an interesting run of films for him, because Rob Reiner's first seven films are all consensus, critically acclaimed movies. It wasn't until his eighth film that he made a bad movie. His first seven are all kind of great. So his first feature was this, and he was known as a sitcom actor. He was Archie Bunker's son on All in the Family. And then he made these movies. He made This is Spinal Tap. Have you seen This is Spinal Tap, Mike?
No.
Oh, Mike. Put it on the list.
then he made Forever.
Then he made The Sure Thing, which is an 80s romantic comedy, you know, teen sex comedy, but it's a really good one. Then he did Stand By Me. Have you seen Stand By Me, Mike? Oh, Mike. Then The Princess Bride. Then When Harry Met Sally. Then Misery. And A Few Good Men. Those were his first seven movies. They're all pretty good. Then he made North. Not good. And since then, he has not made very many good movies. But those first seven are all pretty good, and you've probably not seen any of them, except Princess Bride.
Let me look again.
Have you seen A Few Good Men?
No.
Misery? When Harry Met Sally?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, so a great run of movies, including This is Spinal Tap, which is also... This is Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, and When Harry Met Sally are all in my top 25, probably. So three movies from one director is pretty outstanding, but he had a really good 1980s. Really good 1980s.
I feel like the Mike Watches a Movie vertical could just be renamed the Jason is Disappointed in Mike vertical.
That'll be its subtitle. Mike watches a movie. Jason is disappointed. But we'll get feedback from the listeners. I think putting it at the end is a good decision because people can just dump out if they don't want to listen to us talk about a movie. But there's a precedent for this. I recall John Gruber and Dan Benjamin talking about Bond movies. And if something comes up that it turns out you haven't seen and you feel like you need to see it, or I feel like you need to see it, then maybe we'll revisit this. So we will do Real Genius. We will talk about that, because why not?
Because I want to watch it. I do want to watch it. I have to admit, I have listened to the entire episode of Defocus that you did. I am one of those people
who listens to podcasts about things they haven't seen or read.
Yep, which probably helps with my being able to get the pop culture references.
It's That's like you've seen it.
I know. So I will watch it, but I don't. I kind of listen to it, but when you listen to those things, it doesn't necessarily all go in, I don't think. But I am excited to see Real Genius.
Okay. It's very 80s. Be prepared. Put on some leg warmers.
I'll do what I can. I didn't get a lot of the 80s, so this can be my 80s time. Mm.